Welcome to This Month in Muscular Dystrophy. I'm Kevin Flanagan from the Center for Gene Therapy at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Each month on this podcast, we invite authors of recent publications to discuss how their work improves our understanding of inherited neuromuscular diseases and what their work might mean for treatment of these diseases. I'm pleased to have as our guest today Dr. Paul Martin, Professor of Pediatrics and Physiology and Cell Biology at The Ohio State University and an investigator at the Center for Gene Therapy. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Kevin.
And today we're going to discuss Dr. Martin's recent paper entitled A Human-Specific Deletion in Mouse CMAH Increases Disease Severity in the MDX Model of Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy. And I'll remind our listeners there's a link here on our website that will take you to an abstract of that paper. So, Paul, maybe we could begin with the MDX mouse, the standard model, mouse model for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. How are symptoms in the MDX mouse similar to and different from human Duchenne muscular dystrophy?
Okay, so the MDX mouse is the most commonly used animal model to study Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And in many ways, it's a very appropriate model to use. Genetically, it is contains a mutation in the dystrophin gene that, like many children with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, leads to an absence of the expression of the dystrophin protein in muscle cells. So as a genetic model, it is a very excellent model to study the disease because, like in children with the disease, muscle cells lack the dystrophin protein. Where it is a little bit different is in how the disease progresses in the animal model, and that is something that we and a lot of people have been interested in for many years. The MDX mouse has been known for, like the disease, for over 20 years, and it has a number of features of muscle pathology that are similar to the Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But when you look at it as a whole animal model, the disease develops much later in the mouse than in children. And the severity of the disease pathology is sort of subdued, if you will. So what that means ultimately is that you have a model for the disease that reiterates a number of the aspects of the disease, but where the severity is not as strong. And so what that means in terms of testing therapies, of course, is that you're testing a model where it's sort of like playing a football game where one team has to go 100 yards and the other team has to go 20 yards. And so your therapy might work on the short-term basis, but when you have to put it into children, the standard may be a little higher and a little harder.
I know a lot of parents and others who keep up on these things have seen reports of things that have worked in the MDX mouse, just as you say, that have not been borne out then in the human studies. Is that right?
Right. So there are a number of therapies that have gone to clinic now where they haven't been as dramatically effective in children, some not effective at all, compared to what about the biological effects that were shown in the MDX mouse. And there could be many reasons for that, but one of the reasons probably is that the mouse is not as severely affected. And so what we want to know is, why is that? Are there genetic changes in the mouse that are beneficial for that animal compared to children with the disease? And if so, that'll allow us to do two things. Understand how we got those 80 yards in the first place, and then also open up the ideas about therapies to understand if the mouse can actually lead us to improve therapies in children in such a way that we can get to that 80-yard line at the beginning and then test these therapies that might get you the rest of the way.
Your paper describes how altering glycosylation in the MDX muscle makes the mouse's symptoms worse. Maybe for our listeners, you could describe, if we could start with a few of those terms. You know, what is glycosylation and what are glycans and how is this important to muscle?
Well, glycans are referred to by many names, and so it can get a little confusing. Sometimes they're called sugars, sometimes they're called carbohydrates. Chemists like myself like to use the more technical term, which is glycan. But all of these terms really refer to the same thing, which is that you have these sugar residues that are put onto proteins and lipids on muscle cells and on every cell in the body. And these are modifications that exist that change the functions of these molecules in the cells, including the muscle cells. And so they are really modifiers of other molecules. There are attachments that are put onto them that modify the functions of those proteins and those lipids. And so the reason that these are important in muscle is very clearly because there are a number of diseases, including muscular dystrophies, where glycosylation is altered, and that reduces the stickiness of the membrane for the coating around the muscle cell called the basal lamina. And that connection, which is mediated in part by a protein called dystroglycan, maintains the muscle's ability to withstand structural insults during its movement. Muscle cells are really dramatic in that they have to move a lot and they contract as the cell moves. And so this connection between the muscle cell and the outside of the cell is perturbed when the glycosylation is changed in a number of forms of muscular dystrophy. And so it very clearly is important for maintaining that integrity of the muscle cell during its movement and its resistance to injury.
So in a way, these, simplistically maybe on my part, they can serve sort of as an adhesive in helping the muscle membrane attach to the proteins outside of the muscle fiber. Is that a fair
way? Yeah, exactly. We like to think of it on a very simple term as sort of a glue. That keeps the muscle sort of stickier so that it can be stronger.
So now the CMAH gene, in the title of your paper here, what is the CMAH gene and what does it do?
Well, the CMAH gene, the CMAH is a four-letter abbreviation for the gene name, which is short for the CMP new AC hydroxylase.
So we'll call it CMAH then.
Yeah, it's easier to say CMAH. The reason we're interested in that is because CMAH is a gene that modifies sialic acids, and what it does is it hydroxylates them. It puts a single additional oxygen atom onto sialic acids, and sialic acids are sugars, again, that are at the ends of sugar chains on a number of proteins and lipids in muscle cells. And what we found, we're interested in CMAH for two reasons. One is that it's a genetic difference between humans and all lower mammals. So at some point during evolution, we lost the ability for this gene to work. And that point in evolution, it turns out, was between the great apes and humans. So humans lack the ability of this gene to function because of a deletion that's been introduced in humans, all humans. But all lower organisms, from great apes all the way down to mice, and all lower mammals express this gene normally. So it is a true genetic difference between humans and all animal models that one could make of a disease that one could test. And so in that sense, it's interesting to us from an evolutionary perspective. We lack the ability to put this oxygen onto sialic acids, and all of the animal models where we can test muscle diseases don't lack this gene. And so we can genetically introduce this deletion that's appropriate to humans into the mouse, or really into any other organism, to basically add back this deficit that's specific to us.
That brings us nicely to your paper, which is exactly what you did, introducing this human variation into mice. I was going to say human mutation, but in humans it's not really a mutation, is it? It's
right. It's just something we inherited in the genetic baggage of evolution, right? That led to us not having a functional version of this gene.
But you took this deletion, this variation that's seen in humans, and put it into the mouse version of CMAH, and that's the basis of the animal in your paper, as I understand it.
Right. So we did this in a collaboration with Ajit Varkey at UC San Diego, who's interested in sialic acid biology. And he had made a model for this human deletion. And not surprisingly, when you introduce this deletion into mice, it's not terribly shocking to them. You know, we get along just fine without it,
right.
And they do as well. But when you then ask to introduce that mutation in combination with a human disease, like the MDX mouse model for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, now this gene's absence becomes suddenly more important. And so it's really a modifier of disease rather than a cause of disease, but it is nevertheless important and interesting in that sense. And so what we did was to basically make a double mutant mouse, where this mouse now lacks dystrophin and this CMAH gene. And that is exactly what happens in children with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, because they lack both of those genes as well.
So these mice are genetically a better model, one would say, of disease in humans. What did you find in them?
Well, what we found to our delight and interest was that when you lack both of these genes, the animals show aspects of the human disease that are more like what really happens. So the animals develop a more severe form of muscular dystrophy than the MDX mice normally do. And that is manifested in a number of ways that I think are clinically important in terms of testing therapies in children. The most important of those, of course, are a change in lifespan. So the animals die at a much earlier age than the MDX mice normally do. They die from their muscle disease. And predominantly that is due to changes in muscle biology and physiology that are changes that you would expect in a child with Duchenne. So increases in cardiomyopathy, respiratory insufficiency, and generalized increases in muscle weakness. So these are all things that we want to be able to treat in children with Duchenne. And so in that sense, the animal model is a more robust model to test those sorts of therapies in.
So you anticipate this will be a better tool for discovery of new therapies and trials of new therapies leading to the clinic, I presume. Is that right?
That's our hope, and that's ultimately why we spent so much time characterizing these animals once we realized that they were more severely affected in terms of the disease pathology and the disease physiology. Yes.
What are the next steps from your group in exploring this mouse or this model or therapies in general?
Well, we sort of have a two-pronged approach to understanding this model. One is that we want to know mechanistically, why is it that losing this gene leads to more severe disease? And there are sort of two ideas that we're testing there. One is, what is the loss of function that we've introduced? So by loss of function, I mean, what did we do by eliminating this oxygen from these sialic acids that makes the muscles weaker and more prone to damage? And on the flip side of that is a sort of a more complicated issue, which is what have we done to introduce increased inflammation into the muscle? So by losing this form of sialic acid that is missing in humans, we also have introduced potentially increased immunity to the sugar that has been integrated from the diet. So it turns out that we all, at some level, eat this sugar that we're missing, especially shows up in red meats and dairy products. And it turns out that mouse chow contains a lot of this sugar, too. And so the mice are eating this sugar as well, and so they develop an immunity to the sugar, which is represented by increased antibodies against this sialic acid species. And so we're sort of trying to tease out what the relative contributions are from losing the gene and also from what might be happening when you add the gene back, not the gene back, but the sugar back through diet into the muscle cell. And once we know what the relative merits of the balance of those two things are, I think then we'll have a pretty good idea of how to attack therapeutic approaches. Obviously, if taking the gene and the sugar away is a problem that is increasing the disease, one would create a strategy to add that back somehow, either through gene therapy or through dietary therapy or some sort of therapy where one could introduce the sugar structure back into the cell. And if it's causing problems by eating it, then obviously one would want to avoid that and figure out ways to suppress that sort of response. So these are the sort of the mechanistic questions we're getting at, and ultimately those mechanistic answers will tell us what sort of therapy one might design to ameliorate this genetic deficiency in the disease.
All right. Well, thank you for a very interesting conversation and explaining a very complicated topic to us. So, thanks.
My pleasure.
All right. This podcast is brought to you by Nationwide Children's Hospital. You can find out more about the Muscular Dystrophy Program and ongoing clinical trials at Nationwide Children's at our website, nationwidechildrens.org/muscular-dystrophy-podcast. You'll also find a link to the published abstract of the study that we discussed today. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you again next month.